Good morning. Welcome to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum. My name is Nancy Horowitz, and I am the moderator for this morning's program. Since 1828, the Monadnock Summer Lyceum has been bringing outstanding world-class speakers to the Monadnock region to serve as a catalyst to inform, engage, and inspire an active citizenry on local, national, and global issues. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum is held at the historic Unitarian Universalist Church in downtown Peterborough, New Hampshire, at 11 o'clock on summer Sunday mornings. We invite our New Hampshire Public Radio audience to attend these programs and to meet our speakers at the reception following the program. After the talk, I will read questions from our live audience. And now it is my great pleasure to introduce to you Professor Elizabeth Rees. She received her PhD in history from the University of California at Berkeley. She is professor of women's and gender studies at University of Oregon and is spending her sabbatical in Boston this year, working on a book entitled Private Parts, Public Problems, Genital Surgeries in the United States. She is the author of many books and articles, including Damned Women, Sinners and Witches in Puritan New England, and her latest work, Bodies in Doubt, An American History of Intersex. Her work is far-ranging in its scope, as she is also the editor of several important volumes, including Spellbound, Women and Witchcraft in America, and American Sexual Histories, A Blackwell Reader in American Social and Cultural History. And last but not least, she edited her grandmother's story in a volume entitled Dear Lizzie, Memoir of a Jewish Immigrant Woman. In reading Rees's work, I found myself pondering the compelling connections between her areas of interest that range from the rhetorical strategies through which women in the colonial period responded to the threat of the devil among them, to surgeries which alter physical gender as well as altering our perception of what gender actually is. Her exploration of the tragedy of Puritan women accused of witchcraft sheds light on issues regarding women's identities that are still operant today. And in fact, these legacies emerge quite forcefully in the history of physically alterable gender that Rees analyzes in her current research. Her work is truly groundbreaking, as it explores the relationship between personal and public identity, between perception and reality, and how lives are lived through and despite the obstacles of marginalization and overly facile categorizations. Her presentation today is entitled Confess or Deny, What's a Witch to Do? And now, please join me in welcoming Professor Elizabeth Rees.
Thank you, Nancy, for that introduction. And I'd like to thank Maria Krasinski for originally suggesting that I speak here about my work, and to Nancy and Chris Justice for taking care of some of the details about my presentation. I'll admit that I get a little nervous when I talk to an East Coast audience about Salem. I did grow up in the East Coast, but I've lived in Oregon now for almost 24 years. There are always so many people in the audience whose ancestors were involved in one way or another. And as you might have guessed from Nancy's saying that I edited my grandmother's story, my own relatives didn't come here until 1920, so this is kind of really foreign territory for me. But I have read a lot of the primary sources of what actually happened during the Salem trials, and while I probably won't be able to tell you anything specific about your own relative, sorry about that, if she falls into the category of either a confessor or somebody who denied the charges, then you'll probably better understand her predicament after today's presentation. My book emphasizes two things: the significance of religion to the whole incident, the fact that they were all Puritans, believers in the immediacy of both God and the devil really mattered. Also, my book emphasizes the gender dynamics. Puritans would not have said, if you asked one on the street, that women were more likely to be witches than men. In fact, they thought of women and men as spiritual equals, equally able to cleave to God or to the devil. But nonetheless, what I argue in my book is that I think they did think of women as more likely to cling to the devil. And the numbers kind of speak for themselves. Over 150 people were accused of witchcraft in Salem in 1692, and 78% of those people were women. That's one thing that got me suspicious, that they actually did think that women were more likely to be the ones doing this. Also, the way that women and men responded to the charges against them also differed by their gender, and we'll see that as I get further into this. 19 people were hanged. Of those 19 people, 14 were women and 5 were men. And then one other man was pressed to death with heavy stones because he wouldn't say whether or not he was guilty or innocent. Most of my talk is going to focus on the confessions and the denials, why people would confess, how they confessed, why they denied, why their denials weren't believed. But before I get into that, I have to give a little bit of background about Puritanism and about some of these gender dynamics so it all makes sense to you when you hear this. And I hope that the papers were passed out. We're going to be reading some of those trial transcripts in a few minutes. The Salem witchcraft crisis happened in Puritan New England, and as I mentioned, the fact that they were Puritans was important because all of the people who lived there were very religious Christians. They were called Puritans. They lived in what one historian has termed a world of wonders, which just means that everything was interpreted through the mysterious workings of either God or the devil. Earthquakes, comets, floods, thunderstorms, sickness, everything could be explained through the workings of either Satan or God. They also believed in predestination, which just meant that God had already decided what their fate was going to be after their death, whether or not they were going to go to heaven or hell. And people could never know this while they were alive on earth, but they tried to look for signs of whether they would be among the elect, signs of whether they would end up in heaven, hopefully, or maybe they would be amongst the damned, which obviously they didn't want. So they were constantly kind of evaluating everything that was going on in their life. And I like to think of their lives as a roller coaster in some ways, because when you read some of their spiritual autobiographies, sometimes they were, and these were written only by men, sometimes they were really on an upbeat note, kind of evaluating their life, thinking, you know, things look pretty good. I have a good wife. My children are well-behaved. I have a good job. Things seem to be pretty good. Maybe these are all signs that I indeed will be going to heaven when I die. At other times, they'd be at a real low on this roller coaster ride, thinking, Christ is never going to come to me. I'm definitely a sinner. There's nothing I can do. I can't get out of this. They would be very despondent. And you can see in some of these spiritual autobiographies that they go back and forth thinking about what's going to become of them. When people joined a church, they had to give a conversion narrative. Everybody had to do this. And this meant that they evaluated their life up to that point and basically said, I used to be a terrible sinner. I did this, this, and this bad thing, and now I want to come to Christ and join the church, and I'm going to live my life differently. So men and women both had to give these conversion narratives. Now I have to tell you a little bit about this because it's important later in the witchcraft crisis. Some of these conversion narratives are still out there and scholars can look at them. There's, you know, a few that have survived over the years, which is pretty incredible for early American historians that we have this rich material. So when I looked at the conversion narratives of women and the conversion narratives of men, I noticed some distinctions here. The men tended to be sorry for particular sins. You know, I'm sorry, I lived a sinful life, I drank, I gambled. If they were younger, they might say, I disobeyed my parents. Specific things, I fought, I was quarrelsome, that kind of thing. When the women gave their conversion narratives, I think that they seemed to get at more of the root of their soul. They hardly ever mentioned anything specific. They would say something like, I'm a vile, wretched sinner. I'm a vile, rebellious wretch, one said. I'm the lowest of the low. You know, I'm just a terrible sinner. They never mentioned gambling. They never mentioned drinking. They never mentioned lying or stealing or any other bad thing that you could mention and say, I did these bad things, now I'm going to move on. They always seem to really take it to heart, just the general message of depravity that the ministers might have told them that, you know, this was how people were before they converted and joined a church. Women seem to really take it to heart. And that's important to keep in mind as we listen to these confessions and denials, because Even though the conversion narratives happened in a completely different setting, when there was no witchcraft crisis, I mean, a person would give a conversion narrative when they joined a church, and witchcraft had nothing to do with it, I think that the general gender dynamics were parallel. So that during the witchcraft episodes, the way that women and men responded to these charges against them paralleled the way they thought about themselves as people and as religious people. Now, interestingly, when we read these confessions and denials, it's another important thing to keep in mind is that all of the people who confessed to witchcraft ended up living. They were not killed. And all of the people who denied it were killed. They were the ones who were hanged. When I first saw this, I was really puzzled by it, because you would think that if a person confessed to witchcraft, that's like the worst thing you can confess to. And there's even a biblical response to this, which was, thou shalt not suffer a witch to live. You know, so technically, the people who confessed were supposed to be the ones who were killed, you would think, but they didn't. They put them in prison, and the idea was that they would name more names. They would get more information out of them. Oh, you were at a witch meeting. Who else did you see at the witch meeting? They thought they would get more information that way out of them. That's one reason why the confessors lived. Why the deniers hanged, I think, was that nobody really believed that the deniers were free from all sin. And that, in essence, is what they had to deny. They couldn't just deny that they had nothing to do with witchcraft. Because the definition of a witch was somebody who had signed the devil's book in blood. Somebody who had made a covenant with the devil. You're supposed to make a covenant with God. But a witch was somebody who had made a covenant with Satan. And any sin makes a tiny bit of a covenant with Satan. And so the deniers, when they were getting examined, the magistrates asked them, have you done this? And they said, no. Have you made a covenant with Satan? And they say, no. And then the magistrates say, well, haven't you sinned in some way? And what Puritan altogether, but especially a Puritan woman, could answer, nope, haven't sinned at all, totally free from sin? Nobody would have said that. So the deniers were really in a bind. This is why one of the reasons why I called my book Damned Women, because I feel like they were damned if they did, damned if they didn't. There's really no right response to the kinds of questioning that they were getting. It wasn't clear in the beginning that the confessors would live. People didn't know in advance that this is how things would turn out. But gradually, I think that people must have seen, oh, look, these four deniers were hanged, and these six confessors are still sitting in jail. So when the time came for them when it was somebody's turn to be examined, they must have been terrified. But they were probably thinking, should I say I did it or should I say I didn't do it? I mean, I can imagine that they really must have been racking their brains for what to say that's going to save their lives, because it wasn't clear until later that the confessors were living. At the same time, they wanted to be honest, because to get up there and swear with your hand on the Bible and then tell a lie about what you think happened, that wouldn't have been in their character either to do that. So people are really in a bind about what to do. Let me give some examples. The woman that you read about in the promotion for today's talk was named Alice Parker. Oh, before I talk about her, let me just say one other thing, which is that part of what I think was going on here with these confessions and denials is that they tell us a lot more than just about what was happening at Salem. They really tell us a lot about what it meant to be a good Puritan woman, because that's kind of what they're getting at with all these questionings. And if a person denies it, they can't just deny that they had nothing to do with the devil in this witchcraft episode. They really have to say that they're free from all sin, that they're a perfect wife and mother, that they're a perfect neighbor, that they do everything good. So this kind of gets at what it meant to be a good Puritan woman. And you can also see from this example that I'm about to read what it meant to be a bad Puritan woman and why some people might have been accused, because they were perceived by others to be not so perfect. So this example that was on the publicity for today's talk has to do with a woman, Alice Parker, and something that she did that was not very good Puritan woman-like. John Westgate testified that he was at a tavern when he ran into Alice Parker. She arrived and she, quote, scolded at and called her husband all to naught. So she's at a tavern, she's yelling at her husband. Two bad things right there. Westgate took the husband's side in the marital dispute, suggesting to him that, quote, it was an unbeseeming thing for her to come after him to the tavern and rail after that rate. Alice Parker then called Westgate a rogue and told him to mind his own business. Another bad thing. Now, the incident might have been forgotten, except that Westgate reconstructed it for the court, adding the crucial detail that sometime after he heard a noise and a black hog ran toward him and threatened to devour him. During that scuffle, he realized that the hog was, quote, either the devil or some evil thing, not a real hog, and did then really judge or determine in my mind that it was either Goody Parker or by her means and procuring, fearing that she is a witch. So that was enough of evidence. That kind of thing was enough of evidence that he had this incident with her, who knows how many years ago it was, and she did this, had this unbeseeming conduct. The black hog came toward him. He speculates maybe Goody Parker had something to do with it, and she's called in, and actually she was convicted. And another reason why she was convicted, not just this damning evidence, but she also admitted at the time that she had committed some sin. And in the context of these trials, if you admitted to any sin, that was just a bad idea. You could admit to a sin during your conversion narrative when you were joining the church. That was the proper time to admit to sin and to apologize and to move on and move forward. But to admit to sin in this context, that meant you let the devil in that little bit, and God knows what else would happen down the line. So let's take a look at a confession and a denial, and I would like to call up my dramatic readers for the day, Dorothy Janisch and August Waters. They're going to help do this. And the first one we're going to look at, so this is a double-sided paper that you have. The first one that we're going to look at is Rebecca Nurse. Rebecca Nurse was elderly when this whole thing was happening, and she was very pious, and everybody agreed to her piety, and in fact, they were pretty surprised that Rebecca Nurse would be one who was accused of witchcraft because she was so pious. And where it starts is, these go on for many pages, these confessions and denials. I just picked a page that made several points that I wanted to make, but they ask her, why hasn't she been in church lately? And she says her answer is because she's been sick, and they ask, well, what's your problem? And that's where we're starting in here.
I have none but old age.
You do know whether you are guilty and have familiarity with the devil, and now when you are here present to see such a thing as these testify, a black man whispering in your ear, and birds about you, what do you say to it?
It is all false, I am clear.
Possibly you may apprehend you are no witch, but have you not been led aside by temptations that way?
I have not.
What a sad thing it is that a church member here and now, another of Salem, should be thus accused and charged.
Mrs. Pope fell into a grievous fit and cried out, a sad thing, sure enough, and then many more fell into lamentable fits.
Tell us, have not you had visible appearances more than what is common in nature?
I have no nor never had in my life.
Do you think these suffer voluntary or involuntary?
I cannot tell.
That is strange. Everyone can judge.
I must be silent.
They accuse you of hurting them, and if you think it is not unwillingly but by design, you must look upon them as murderers.
I cannot tell what to think of it.
Afterwards, when this was somewhat insisted on, she said, "I do not think so. She did not understand aright what was said."
"Well then, give an answer now. Do you think these suffer against their wills or not?"
"I do not think that these suffer against their wills."
"Why did you never visit these afflicted persons?"
"Because I was afraid I should have fits too."
Upon the motion of her body, fits followed upon the complainants, abundantly and very frequently.
"Is it not an unaccountable case that when you are examined, these persons are afflicted?"
"I have got no body to look to but God."
Again, upon stirring her hands, the afflicted persons were seized with violent fits of torture.
"Do you believe these afflicted persons are bewitched?"
"I do think they are."
Okay, we'll stop there for now. Thank you. Okay, so there's just a few things that I want to highlight in this reading. The first thing that I have underlined here, possibly you may apprehend you are no witch, but have you not been led aside by temptations that way? That's a perfect example of how the magistrates were trying to get the people who were being examined to admit to some kind of sin. It's as if they're saying, okay, you haven't done this, but haven't you done any other sin? And again, you know, what person could say they haven't done a sin? They haven't sinned at all. And she's kind of trying to say that, but they're pushing her. They don't want to believe that, because no person would have been able to say they were without sin. This business about the fits, you know, other people having lamentable fits. What this refers to is that in the courtroom, which was the meeting house, when a person was being examined, some of the accusers would start having really these fits of just screaming and saying, "She's pinching me, can't you see?" and falling on the floor and collapsing, and that would cause everybody else to start screaming, and you know, it was just quite a scene. One of the audience members here told me that they were related to Mary Esty, who was a Rebecca Nurse's sister, and she was one of the women who said, who kind of stopped the trials, one of the factors, because she suggested to the magistrates, "Why don't you interrogate these people individually and not publicly? Because when you're doing it publicly, one thing leads to another, and you know, panic is ensuing here when these fits are starting to happen and then everybody joins in on the action." And when that started happening, that did contribute to the whole thing kind of dying down. There were other things as well, which I can talk about in the question session. But anyway, that's what they're referring to. That, and some people who, even people who thought that the whole thing was taking on a crazy character and going in the wrong direction, even some of those people who were skeptical were concerned about those fits. What are those fits? Something that was going on was that they believed in spectral evidence, which meant that once you signed the devil's book in blood, by doing that, you gave the devil permission to take your shape invisibly and go around hurting others, pinching them, torturing them, doing whatever, appearing to them. But the tricky thing about this, of course, is that it was invisible. So nobody, if one of the complainants said, "Oh, look, there's Rebecca Nurse. She's pinching me. She's torturing me. Help, help." Nobody else could see Rebecca Nurse, her specter, or anybody's specter. But when you have that kind of evidence, you can see how things could take a dangerous path with that kind of evidence. And so anyway, that's what they're talking about here with these fits, that these are specters that are appearing to people, causing bad things to happen. And when we read the next one in a minute, we'll see this will come up again. Later on, her relatives, her male relatives, wrote a petition basically trying to exonerate her of the charges and to say she has been perfect in every respect. She hasn't sinned, and she hasn't sinned in her regular life, and she hasn't been involved with this witchcraft either. But this petition, it didn't work, and Rebecca Nurse was hanged along with the other deniers. But when I read this part, and I'm going to read it to you out loud, it really struck me how sad this whole thing was, because people were really trying to evaluate their own inner lives and their souls, their sense of themselves as sinners, and trying to navigate that with what was happening during this terrible time. So in the petition, it says this. We told her, meaning these are her relatives, we told her we heard that she was spoken of also. Well, she said, if it be so, the will of the Lord be done. She sat still a while, being, as it were, amazed. And then she said, well, as to this thing, I am innocent as the child unborn. But surely, she said, what sin has God found out in me unrepented of, that he should lay such an affliction upon me in my old age? That just moved me so much that she, you know, she's still, even though she knows she didn't sign the devil's book, she knows she didn't do anything bad, she's still searching her soul for that one sin that she still hasn't repented of that is the cause of all of this. Okay, so let's move to a confession now on the other side of your papers. This is a confession by Abigail Hobbs. What I think is so interesting is to look at not only the fact that they confessed, and we don't really know, you know, what Abigail Hobbs' if she had a strategy, what she was, you know, why she chose to take this route. Did she really think she signed the devil's book, or did she see that people weren't hanging and maybe this was a route to go? That's possible. But it's interesting to look at how she confessed, the kinds of things that she needs to put in this confession to make it credible to the magistrates, because they also could say, you know, your confession sounds like you're making this all up. We don't even believe you. So there were certain elements in here that I think, looking at the confessions where the people actually lived, that these elements had to be in here. So go ahead.
He said he would give me fine things if I did what he would have me.
What would he have you do?
What? He would have me be a witch.
Would he have you make a covenant with him?
Yes.
And did you make a covenant with him?
Yes, I did, but I hope God will forgive me.
The Lord give you repentance. You say you saw dogs and many sorts of creatures.
I saw them at that time.
But have you not seen them at other times, too?
Yes.
Where?
At our house.
What were they like?
Like a cat.
What would the cat have you do?
She had a book and would have me put my hand to it.
And did you?
No, I did not.
Well, tell the truth. Did you at any other time?
Yes. I did that time at the Eastward.
What other creatures did you see?
I saw things like men.
What did they say to you?
Why, they said I had better put my hand to the book.
You did put your hand to the book, you say?
Yes, one time.
What? Would they have you put your hand to their book, too?
Yes.
And what would they have you do then? Would they have you worship them?
They would have me make a bargain for so long and do what they would have me do.
For how long?
Not for above 2 or 3 years.
How long did they agree with you for?
But for 2 years.
And what would they then do for you?
They would give me fine clothes.
And did they?
No.
When you set your hand the last time to the book, how long was that for?
It was for 4 years.
How long is that ago?
It is almost 4 years. The book was brought to me to get my hand to it for 4 years, but I never put my hand but that once at Eastward.
Are you not bid to hurt folks?
Yes.
Who are you bid to hurt?
Marcy Lewis and Ann Putman.
What did you do to them when you hurt them?
I pinched them.
How did you pinch them? Did you go in your own person to them?
No.
Doth the devil go for you?
Yes.
And what doth he take, your spirit with him?
No. I am as well as at other times. But the devil has my consent and goes and hurts them.
Who hurt your mother last Lord's Day? Was it not you?
No.
Who was it?
I heard her say it was Goody Wilds at Topsfield.
Have you been in company with Goody Wilds at any time?
No, I never saw her.
Well, who are your companions?
Why, I have seen Sarah Good once.
How many did you see?
I saw but two.
Did you know Sarah Good was a witch when you saw her?
Yes.
How did you know it?
The devil told me.
Okay, that's perfect. Thank you so much. That was the best dramatic reading I've ever had. So there are a few things to highlight here. First of all, you can tell that they're pressing her, but no matter how confused the answers are, you know, I was there for 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, it doesn't really matter in some ways. She's confused, and because I think that she doesn't really know what to say that's going to get her off. But those details really aren't so critical. The details that are critical is that on the top of the left-hand column where I underlined that she hopes that God will forgive her. An apology and a confession was key because the Puritans were all about repentance, and she is apologizing here. I think they would have really liked to heard that. It's like, okay, you did this bad thing, you signed the devil's book, but now you're sorry. The part where it starts with that he said he would give me fine things, and on the second column, they would give me fine clothes, and did they? And the answer is no. What she's referring to there is that these Satan, she calls them men or a cat or dogs, whatever form Satan appeared in, wanted to offer her something. And that really paralleled the kind of language that the ministers would have talked about in the sermons that they went to all the time. These people were always in church listening to the minister's messages about Satan's temptations and how his temptations are always there, ready to lure you at any moment. But if you fall for Satan's temptations, the ministers would have said, he doesn't come through with his end of the bargain. And here, in this context of the witchcraft trials, it's exactly that. What she's saying, it would have resonated with these ministers because who were there and the magistrates, because they would be thinking, oh, yes, that's just like Satan. He offered you things. Oh, he offered you clothes. Yep, didn't come through with it. Makes sense. That's how he is. So what she was saying would have been very familiar to them, and they would have, you know, believed her because of that kind of thing that she put in there. And then the part where it says, the devil has my consent. So here again, she's talking about the spectral evidence. How did she go to hurt Mercy Lewis and Ann Putnam? She didn't go herself, she says, but the devil has her consent. She signed that book, and that signature, that consent, made it so that she could go and hurt other people. That consent was very important. Oh, and then also the fact that she does name other people. So you could see how the magistrates would be thinking, well, let's keep these confessors around because, look, they're very helpful to us. She's mentioning Sarah Good here. And other confessors mentioned other people. In fact, one of the surest way to avoid scrutiny yourself was to mention other people and to hope that the magistrates seized on that and went to examine those other people. Okay, I want to read now a woman's confession that I think shows the fine line between regular sinning and this more horrible sin of witchcraft and how these, of signing the devil's book, how these things sometimes became merged in people's minds during the confusion and the tumult and the anxiety and worry about what to say when you're actually the one up on the stand. This woman, Rebecca Eames, she mentions in here her previous sin of adultery. So you know that this is something that's probably weighing on her mind when she's in front of the magistrates in this way. She explained to the court that immediately after making a black mark with her finger, sealing the covenant, so she signed the devil's book, but she wasn't literate, so she made it with a black mark. This is a quote. She was then in such horror of conscience that she took a rope to hang herself and a razor to cut her throat by reason of her great sin in committing adultery. And by that the devil gained her, he promising that she should not be brought out are ever discovered. So that's her confession, which to me displays this really terrible confusion. Was she horrified by the evil pact of signing her mark in the devil's book? Or was she horrified by her confrontation by the previous sin of adultery? Or did she believe that basically she did covenant with the devil because of that previous sin of adultery? And so that kind of confession to me says that there's something else that's going on here, that these women are so wrecked with guilt of how they were vile, rebellious wretches, that she's able to make her confession in this way. When I read this and so many of these other confessions, I wanted to just say, no, don't bring up that adultery. They're not asking you about that. Forget about that. But, you know, they're really turning to their inner selves to see what they have done. Like Rebecca Nurse said, what sin has God found out in me unrepented of? They're looking for that in themselves. Okay, there were some people that recanted, that first admitted and then first said that they had done something and then recanted. And that's very interesting, too. I'm going to read this one woman's recantation because I think it tells a lot. Sarah Churchill, she said that her confession was motivated by three things. One was that she had been threatened and told that they would put her in the dungeon. But she persisted in her story for so long that now she was afraid, that she thought that there was no way to get out of it after she had persisted for so long. She said insightfully that if she told Mr. Noyes but once that she had set her hand to the book, he would believe her. But if she told the truth and said she had not set her hand to the book 100 times, he would not believe her. And then finally, I'd like to look at one of the men's confessions, because they did confess a little bit differently. First of all, they were much bolder in the whole response to all of it. One man said, "Well, burn me or hang me, I will stand in the truth of Christ. I know nothing of it." So that's pretty brash way of saying his denial, much different from the way Rebecca Nurse was denying it. Another man, Andrew Carrier, when I read you this, you can see some of the elements that Abigail Hobbs had in hers, and especially in terms of what the devil was going to offer. He received a very enticing offer. He admitted that the devil offered him a house and land in Andover. Still very tempting, probably, to this day, right? Unable to resist that tempting offer, he was ready to sign the book. He saw that the ink was red, but he couldn't make out the rest of the names on the list. He saw the devil's seal, but he couldn't discern the stamp because it was nighttime. He went to the meeting and saw others there, but he had forgotten their names. He drank the wine, but he didn't eat the bread. He witnessed the Lord's Supper, but he didn't hear the exact words used at the administration of the sacrament. His confession did save him, but it's very different from the other ones because you can really see that he doesn't know what to say, but it doesn't really matter that much for the men because they did not expect that men would be subject to Satan in this way and become sinners. Some were, and there were some men who were killed because of it, but he wasn't pressured to admit past sins, that the magistrates did not associate his character with his purported deeds, because the court, the accusers, the witnesses, and even the accused themselves all believed that women were more likely to be witches than men, and because of that, women had a much harder time establishing their innocence.
Thank you, Professor Rees. This is the Monadnock Summer Lyceum, hosted by the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire, and broadcast on New Hampshire Public Radio. We have some time for questions from the audience. While the ushers collect them, let me begin by asking, what is the legacy, do you think, of these witchcraft trials? Do you think that the identity of the Puritan woman changed as a result of them?
That's an interesting question. There's an immediate legacy and a longer legacy that I can speak to. The immediate legacy is that almost right after the Salem trials, the whole thing was seen as kind of a big embarrassment because people saw that it got so way out of hand, more than they anticipated. And I looked at a lot of the sermons after Salem, sermons from the early 1700s, to see if the ministers talked about Satan in a different way, because I felt that the way they talked about Satan as such an immediate presence in people's lives, always around a corner, always behind a tree, always there, ready to lure you, from my perspective, this might have contributed to the whole thing because they saw Satan so present in their life. After Salem, the way the ministers started to talk about the devil changed. And they still believed in God and the devil, of course. They were still religious Christians. They weren't going to, you know, abandon that. But they talked about the devil in a more distant way. He was in hell. If you were to be one of the unfortunate ones to go to hell, you'd see him there. But he wasn't so much around every corner anymore. At least that's how they put forward that message in their sermons. And maybe that had, maybe that was a legacy of Salem, to kind of keep Satan a little bit distant. In terms of the legacy of Salem today, I'm sure all of you have read Arthur Miller's The Crucible. Well, that's not today. That's already 50 years ago or more. But I think that that kind of tendency to see everything in stark black and white terms, you're either with the devil or you're with God, you're either good or you're evil. I think that Arthur Miller did such a brilliant job of portraying that in The Crucible, and I actually think that a lot of the way that we look at things in our country today can be a little bit like the way the Puritans looked at things, with not a lot of tolerance for ambiguity. Sorry to say, I wish I could say that we've all abandoned that rigid past, but I think that we can still see hints of it today.
Thank you. Can you speak a little bit more about the events and factors that actually stopped these trials?
Well, one was, as I mentioned, the Mary Estes' suggestion of interrogating these people in private, which was huge. Another factor had to do with the ministers who actually got together, ministers from Salem and ministers from Boston. There were about a dozen of them, I believe. They got together to talk about what was going on and try to stem the fanaticism that some people, you know, thought that it was moving towards. And they wrote a treatise about Satan's powers. Now, it seems kind of ironic that writing a treatise about Satan's powers and about the scope of his powers, which they felt was so huge, that would actually stem the tide of these accusations and the way they were playing out. But they did, because what they wrote in this treatise was that Satan is very powerful. And if he wants to get somebody's shape to go harm others, what does he need their signature in a book for? He can just go get it. So they said, you know, we don't have to have a person like Abigail Hobbs saying, "I consented to the devil," and that made her a witch by that consent. These ministers said, the devil doesn't need people's consent. If he wants their shape, he wants to go torment others, he'll just go grab it. So forget about all of this. That was basically what those ministers wrote. And I think that they wrote this actually earlier on, but the magistrates didn't really pay much attention to it. But as time went on, and more really pious, really prominent people were getting accused, then they turned back to what these ministers had said and said, yeah, you know, the devil's so powerful, ironically, we don't have to look for a person's consent. And that started to diminish the whole thing as well.
I think this leads us right to the next question. In your talk, you spoke about the responses to accusations, but you must have an opinion regarding the causes of the hysteria that was experienced?
I don't really have an opinion about the causes of the hysteria. It's a lot of historians have written about this. Other really great historians, if people want to read more about this, I can talk to you after about particular things to read. There's been a lot of sociological work about where people lived, who was mad at who, also some political factors that were going on in terms of the charter in Salem, some answers having to do with the crisis of Indian wars in the area. There are a lot of potential reasons for why this might have happened at this time. But I think that as a historian, I feel a little uncomfortable saying, oh, yes, this one reason. sparked the whole thing, because usually in life, things are just so much more complex than just one reason tipping something off. People all in the area believed in witchcraft, they believed in God, they believed in Satan. It could have happened in many places, and in fact did happen in other places. Salem was just the most egregious of the whole episode, but there were other witchcraft episodes earlier. There was one in Hartford. There were others in earlier decades as well. So I think it's almost too simple to say there's just one reason for why it happened in Salem. Some people have asked me in the past, wasn't there ergot poisoning, that some of the accusers had ingested some kind of poison from wheat? That's the suggestion, and that was an explanation for the fits, and that caused everything. And I'm a little skeptical of that explanation as well, because even if they had ingested something poisonous, that doesn't explain everybody's response to the behavior. So if that was such a simple answer, it'd be great if that was a simple answer, but it doesn't explain the way the magistrates pushed people to say certain things and what they're looking for and to confess in certain ways or why they didn't believe the denials. So I just think that there's more to it, and as in most things, it's more complex.
Thank you. What percent of the general population of Salem was the 150 unfortunate people that were tried? Did the trials cause an exodus from the Puritan church or strengthen their faith?
These are very good questions. I can't remember offhand how many people were living in Salem, but I'm not even going to make a ballpark estimate, because this is going to be on the radio and someone's bound to write in and say, no, she's completely off. It was this many people. But I will say that it was a large percentage, and everybody would have known either accusers, the accused, the people that are denying, the people that are confessing. Everybody was involved with this because it was a very small face-to-face community where people knew each other. And in terms of whether or not Puritanism, people stayed being religious. I don't think that it made anybody leave the faith because of it. In fact, I can imagine that people were strengthened by their faith, as they often are in a time of crisis. They're strengthened by their faith, and they just think that people took a wrong path. But if you truly believe in the way that you're supposed to believe, you know, that this kind of thing can be avoided in the future. Years later, one of the women involved apologized in the early 1700s. And the apology basically said, I did this because the devil was in my heart. And so, you know, again, we still have, the devil was still looming very large in her explanation for why, you know, why she had been involved with the whole thing. And by the 1700s, if somebody says the devil is in my heart, people understood that in a metaphorical way, whereas if that same person had said this back in 1692, and this happened to people, if they said the devil's in my heart, I did X, Y, or Z sin, the magistrates would have responded, really? The devil's in your heart? What shape? How did he appear to you? Did he bring a book? It's just a very different context. So to say it in 1706 or whenever she apologized was much different circumstances.
Thank you. Why were women called Goody? Were they forced to live up to this name as Puritan women? And at what age did they join the church?
Goody, that just meant you were a married woman. And it doesn't, that's just meant that. It was your status. And people could join the church at different ages, but mostly people joined the church probably late teens, early 20s. And you were, of course, encouraged to join the church, but it did mean it wasn't as easy as it is now. You know, you couldn't just sign up or start coming to church. You did have to give this conversion narrative. And in the beginning, those were given publicly. After a while, people started to think that it wasn't appropriate for women to speak in public in a mixed audience, and mixed meant men and women. So they would take the women aside in the minister's chambers and listen to the conversion privately.
Let's take the example of demonic possession or witchcraft in popular representations in the media and in literature. Women are portrayed much more prone to this kind of possession or witchcraft. And how much do you think these representations contribute to social belief about women?
These questions require more thought than just off the top of my head. I think that all of the ways that women are portrayed in the media contributes to the ways in which they're expected to behave. I think that that's just part of it. That's one way that people kind of connect women with evil, even though they wouldn't say this if you asked them on the street. If people, you know, they wouldn't think that women were more evil than men or more, I don't know, sexual or more temptresses, but maybe it's part of our broader culture that we can't really escape from, and it probably does have some bearing on how women are expected to be. I mean, all of it, all of what goes on around us in terms of the gendered portrayals of men and women has some effect, I'm sure. Advertising, it's hard to put your finger on it. Again, it's hard to say because of this, then this. But I think there's probably something to that. I don't know how many people, well, probably all of you have been to Salem. When I talk about this in Oregon, nobody's been to Salem, but it's interesting to go to Salem and see how the witches, how this whole episode is portrayed there. And they have one very good thing, which is a memorial to the women that were hanged. And they have the Peabody Essex Museum, which is fabulous. But they also have some very kitschy and commercial things going on there that I think if I had a relative who had died in this episode, I would not feel very good about this. Like, for instance, the symbol of a witch flying on a broom is the town symbol, and it's on the police car, and it's the high school symbol, and you know, to me, it just trivializes this horrible tragedy that happened. People died here. They were not doing anything bad, and they were killed. And so I think that that kind of commercialization and kitschiness is a little unfortunate. There's a good movie called Witch City that talks about all the different elements in Salem today. The historians, a lot of contemporary witches, women who practice Wicca, practice contemporary witchcraft, think of these women as their martyred spiritual ancestors, and so they want to live there. So there's a lot of witches that live there. I think there's the largest concentration of witches in the country that live there. And then there's some right-wing Christians that live there that still want to exorcise Satan from the midst there. And then there's all the tourists that come to see. So it's a very interesting place to go, especially around Halloween, which of course Halloween had nothing to do with these Puritans, but that is the time when witches come to mind. And so if you go there around Halloween, it's really something to see.
Is there any evidence that there were actual witches that practicing witchcraft in Salem at this time?
There is no evidence that any women were actually practicing witchcraft, which is kind of strange that that contemporary witches would use these women, you know, would think of these women as their martyred spiritual ancestors, because they weren't practicing anything like any, you know, harvest festivals or anything that contemporary people might do. They might have practiced some magic. All Puritans practiced some magic, like, for instance, putting a horseshoe over a door to ward off evil, that kind of thing. But everybody did that. So the people that were accused weren't doing anything especially bad. So no, there isn't. Now, it maybe, you know, years down the line, somebody will uncover some evidence saying, oh, look, here Rebecca Nurse was. Here's the evidence. Here's the devil's book. She did sign. But I really don't think that we're ever going to find that. I think that these were good, religious, thoughtful people who were in the wrong place at the wrong time, not really knowing what the right answer was to save themselves, And it's just very sad.
We have time for just one more question, and this question brings us into contemporary times. Do you see anything similar in the Salem witch trials and the 1950s McCarthy hearings, or even the devilish political accusations in the current campaign speeches, commercials, and so on?
Yeah, I think that, you know, I mentioned this earlier, our willingness to see things without complexity. I think I'll put it that way. Our willingness to see things in really black and white terms with nothing, with no ambiguity at all, and our willingness to kind of jump on the bandwagon of wanting to blame somebody for something. I think that we just kind of all need to, or blame a group of people for something without really just taking a step back and saying, what's really going on here? I think that is one of the unfortunate legacies that is still with us.
Thank you again, Professor Rees, for sharing your time and experience with us today. You have been listening to Monadnock Summer Lyceum on New Hampshire Public Radio. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum presents a weekly series of lectures held at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire. For more information about the Lyceum, you can visit our website at monadnocklyceum.org or by writing the Monadnock Lyceum Committee, 25 Main Street, Peterborough, New Hampshire, 03458.